All right, tonight we begin what will be a 5+ years survey through the Bible. For those who have not been a part of this, as we began last time, 5 or 6 years ago, a little over 6 years ago, this is a survey. And by that we simply mean we're not intending to be detailed to the point that we're covering half a chapter. For example, Genesis chapter 1, we could spend several weeks on. But we're going to cover chapters 1 and 2 as well as some introductory things. So it is kind of fast pace, but even at that, it takes us 5 years to complete the Bible. If we slowed it down half to what we're doing now, or twice as long, I suppose, it would take us 10 years. And so the child in these smaller classes would only go through the cycle one time by the time they graduate high school. So anyway, this is what we're embarking upon, is a 5-year survey. And so it is going to be fast-paced in many regards, but those who've been used to that, you know where we're going. I want to do some introductory things, not merely for us, but there are a number of people who listen online as these things are posted, and we're redoing some of our videos that are already up. And so I want to give a brief introduction to some Old Testament things to introduce Old Testament studies. And this is quite simplistic. I want to talk first about the divisions of the Old Testament books. Our Bibles are divided by subject matter. That's how they're arranged. They're arranged as a Bible library. The first section of books is called the Law, or the Pentateuch, penti meaning five. And that is the first 5 books, or it's also been referred to as the books of Moses. We'll say more about that in a moment. That's where we are. We're starting there. There is a history section, then there's the poetry and prophecy, and we'll get to all of that a little bit later. So we're looking at the law section, and this is not particularly law, but it is in the law section because Moses was the lawgiver. Now, the theme of the Old Testament is something we need to keep in mind as we embark upon any book of the Old Testament. I think we have a misconception when we think that the Bible is just a bunch of miscellaneous books about different subjects. That's partly true. But each book of the Bible focuses on this phrase, on this concept of Christ the Redeemer. Every book, every single one of them somehow focuses on that. And that's the golden thread that ties all of these books together. I want you to pay attention right here, the highlighted section. The book of Genesis and Exodus and Leviticus and Numbers and even Deuteronomy is part of this message where God is building a nation through whom the Christ the Redeemer is going to come. Is there more to this book than that? Sure, there is. But it ties with this theme as God is building a nation through whom the Redeemer is going to come. And so that's the value of this book. And then when you get to Exodus, it connects to Christ the Redeemer and Leviticus. You name the book and it relates to the subject. I want to briefly talk about a Bible timeline, and you're not going to remember all of this. I'm not going to remember it either, all of it. But I want you to get a concept of a Bible timeline. This is from Bible Manna. Some brethren put this together a number of years ago in a Bible program. But nonetheless, you may be following a chronology that varies a little bit. Now, I'm going to give you some dates as we go along. My dates are generally taken from Frank Klassen's chronology. There are other chronologies, and you may be following a different one, that you're going to be off by a number of significant years. And I'm not concerned about that. And you really shouldn't be either, because we're not all in agreement on the exact date. But here's what I'm interested in looking at this chronology or looking at a timeline. When we get, for example, to creation, and we'll give you some dates on with reference to that. But when we come to, say, for example, Noah, how many years have passed? That's the general concept I want us to get to. So was that like 5 years later, or is that 1,000 years later? There's a big difference. So those kinds of dates are the dates we're going to give. And so you, if you're following a different chronology, it's going to be approximately the same gap of time, but it may be a different date that's given. So don't get excited if your dates differ. But we're going to look at some of this chronology, starting with Adam all the way down to Noah, and we'll get to Noah next time. Now, that's not the last time you'll see that slide or that chart. So let's look at some introductory things, as we always do, to a book, and it's introduced the book of Genesis. The author is Moses. But he's never mentioned as being the author in the book. Unlike, say, Romans, the author is mentioned in verse 1. 1 Corinthians, the author is mentioned at verse 1. But we don't have that in Genesis, and so how do we come to that conclusion? I'm not going to trace the references. I'm giving them to you. And let me stop and footnote, if several of you are on a list and asked to be on a list to receive these slides in advance of the class, and you're getting those. And if you're not getting those and you want on the list, make sure I get an email from you. You send me an email and say, I want to be added to the list. And you'll get that every week, just a little while before class. But nonetheless, and that includes people online. If you want that, you can get that as well. But nonetheless, God used Moses to write. Now, these passages mentioned here in Exodus and Joshua, this simply said that God was writing through Moses. And that the section that we call the Pentateuch, or the law, was referred to as the law, or referred to sometimes as Moses. And so generally it was understood that he wrote those five books, though that is in question by some. Now Moses wrote the law section because these passages, John 7, Luke 16, and Luke 24, in referring to the law section, referred to it as Moses. They have Moses and the prophets. And so as Moses was referred to, it's referring to that section that the Jews referred to as the law, which included Genesis, Exodus, Leviticus, Numbers, and Deuteronomy. Now, the writing of Genesis could not have started until after the burning bush, where God called him to be a prophet and God called him to do the work and the mission that he did. So it's not like, because Moses didn't come along till later, he's not writing on this eighth day after creation. No evidence of that kind of thing taking place at all. Now, what about the date? Now, this is where we get into some of the chronology. When this book was written is uncertain, but it had to be before Moses' death, which generally is put around 1500 B.C. So, obviously, if he's going to write, it's going to be before his death. That's kind of obvious. But this point B is where, and C is where you may have some information you want to jot down in the margin of your Bible. I encourage you to write in pencil because you may want to change that. I've changed a number of opinions on dates and outlines that I put together, and that's why I encourage you to write that in pencil. But the period covered, Classen puts the creation about 3975 B.C., and you look at someone in there, they're at 4100. Okay, no big deal. We don't know exactly, but that's the general idea. And so the evidence is, and I don't have time to give it, is we have a relatively young Earth. It's not millions of years. It's not tens of thousands of years old. If it's 2,000 years to Christ, and then from Christ back to Moses, let's give it 5,000 even. At 5,000, 5 plus 2, we're less than 10. So 10,000 years or less is the age of the earth. It's a relatively young earth. Josh Gertler will get into that in March when he's with us. But nonetheless, 3975 at creation, 1606 B.C. would be Joseph at the end of the book. So that's approximately 2,369 years. Now again, that's not an exact number. As Jason Baxter said, he gives us a history in the book of Genesis of the first 2,500 years of the history of man. And that's what I want you to see. That's what I'm after. And so you say, well, I think it was 2,350. I said, no, I think it was 2,572. I'm not going to argue with that. I can't. I'm just saying about 2,500 years is the history of the book of Genesis. Make sense? All right. That's where we're headed with our chronologies, just those general terms. Now, let's talk about the message of the book. It is the beginning. The name Genesis simply means the origin or the beginning or the origination of something. And so it's the beginning. It's the beginning of the story that we've already talked about of how God built a nation through which the Messiah was going to come. And so where did this nation of the Jews, the Hebrews, come from? And we see that. And so a general synopsis of Genesis, we have God creating the world by chapter 10, we and man, and then we have in Genesis chapter 10, the creation of the nations, the formation of the nations, maybe a better word. Then chapter 12, we have the zeroing in on one nation, that is the family of Abraham, and that's the focus of the rest of the Bible. Now, this book has the beginning of a number of things. I don't know about you, but I'm always fascinated with the origin. Where was the first? Even in our own day and time, where was the first particular thing that I might be interested in? Who made the first table saw? Who made the first race engine? Who made the first, invented the first baseball game? Whatever. All right, here's some number first. Here's the beginning of life, the beginning of man, the beginning of the covenant, a first covenant, chapter 2, the beginning of the home and the marriage, beginning of family problems, beginning of sibling rivalry, the beginning of sin, the beginning of the plan of redemption, first time it was ever mentioned. The beginning of crime, the first murder. The beginning of worship, the beginning of nations, and the beginning of the Hebrew nation. No wonder this is called Genesis, the beginning. Make sense? All right. All right, we got some ground to cover. Let's keep going. This is a foundation book. Here's the importance of Genesis. If we get fouled up on Genesis, then we're going to be fouled up on every book for here on out till we get to Revelation, and probably won't make it to Revelation. Here's why. The questions that we need to answer and are going to be, and one of the reasons that we decided to start now with our survey versus waiting another year, is that Josh Gertler is coming to deal with evolution in March. And a weekend meeting starts, I think, on a Thursday, or maybe it's Thursday, and go through Sunday. I think we have six lessons planned. But anyway, we need to answer these kind of questions. Is Genesis 1 through 11 real history, or is it a myth? There are some of our brethren arguing that Genesis 1 through 11 is not true history. It's just a myth. It's all a fable. It's all written in poetry. It is simply exaggerated. All this stuff is exaggerated. It didn't really happen, as the text says. Are the days of Genesis 1 literal 24-hour periods? What about the serpent? Is he real? There's some of our brethren who have argued that the serpent did not literally really talk to Eve. What about the flood of Genesis 6, 7, 8, and 9? Was it a universal flood, or was it a local phenomenon? And furthermore, Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, were they real people, or is this just kind of a made-up story? And you say, I know those evolutionists, I know those atheists. No, we're talking among brethren, these are problem questions. Among brethren, these are problem questions. Like we talked on Sunday night about imputed righteousness. Now, how we treat Genesis and those questions has everything to do with our view of inspiration. Show me somebody that questions those things being real, and I'll show you somebody who has a problem comprehending verbal inspiration. I'll guarantee that. They have a problem with verbal inspiration. The second thing, our confidence in the rest of the Bible is shot. If I can't believe Genesis 1 and 2 on the days of creation, how can I believe what he said on marriage in Matthew 19? Or on the Lord's Supper in 1 Corinthians 11? Or anything else for that matter? Or why does it matter? So this is a foundation book. All right, now that's a brief, very brief introduction. But we've got to do some of that to get into the book. So here's what the book is about, by way of outline. And as you know, I think we ought to outline a book to give the general structure of the book. This is borrowed from Dehoff, Baxter, and then I've tweaked it. So who put this together? I borrowed from those two guys and made it my own. So give Baxter and Dehoff credit. Two things happen in the book. There is the early history, and I word that on purpose, that it is history. Early history, chapters 1 through 11, and in that we see the creation, the fall, the flood, the Tower of Babel. Is there more in that? Sure, but that gives us a general structure. And then there's the patriarchal history. There's the chosen family of Abraham, Isaac, Jacob, and Joseph. And then we back up to 32 and come tracing through from 32 to 50 of the descent into Egypt, so that when we open the book of Exodus, now we understand what's going on of them being in Egypt. Make sense? God has chosen a nation, and before the book is through, he's preserving this nation. Make sense? Because there is a Messiah coming. That's why the books are important. Make sense? Tracking with me? All right. With that in mind, let's go here. Let's go to Genesis chapter 1. We will not always answer our questions. Depending on the time, we will answer some of our questions. So don't get excited that we don't get to the questions. They are... they're there when we need them. Let's just go to our outline first, and then we'll come back to our questions. Here's what's happening in Genesis 1. We all are familiar in this group. We're familiar with Genesis 1. By that, I simply mean we pretty much are, there's nothing here that's going to shock you. Like, I don't remember reading that. We're going to make some comments, but I want to drive on to chapter 2 and some of the questions about chapter 2. And we're going to try to deal with some of these questions in chapter 1. I don't mean the questions I've asked you, but questions that people ask. So chapter 1, I simply call for my purpose. You give your own title to that for your study, because 3 years from now, and you're talking to somebody, if the 6 days of creation doesn't describe Genesis 1, you put the title there that you think. But it does deal with the 6 days of creation. And so we have the 6 days, so there's our 6 points. So let's get underway. On the first day, what happened? That takes us from verse 1 to verse 6, or verse 5 rather, I'm sorry. What happened on the first day? All right. Now there's something to raise. In the beginning, this is the beginning of the creation of things that God has made. Was there anything before that? And the answer is yes, because in the beginning there was. The Word was with God and the Word was God. God is eternal. So before God created, God is eternal. There was the plan that God had from the foundation of the world. Remember that? Ephesians chapter 1, 1 to 4. But I'm not so much interested in that at this juncture. We'll get to that a little bit later on. But now notice in verse 2 that as the earth was without form and void, and the Spirit of God hovered over the face of the deep. Now, I don't have time to develop the work of the Father, the work of the Son, and the work of the Holy Spirit, but the Son executed the plan according to Hebrews chapter 1 and John chapter 1, the first 3 verses of both of those chapters. All right, since He executed the plan, but the Father has the plan of creation, the Spirit is involved somehow. What's He doing? I take verse 2 to tell me that the Holy Spirit is working in organizing. To what degree? I don't know. But He hovered over the face of the earth, and the Spirit of God hovered over the face of the waters. You might look at Deuteronomy 32:11 as a comparison for this concept of hovering. Now, that's all I really intend to say about that, because I don't know much more to say about that. So God created the heavens and the earth. What else did He do on the first day? All right, He said, let there be light, and then there was light. And God saw that it was good. In fact, a number of times through this chapter, God said it was good, it was good, it was good. And then on the sixth day, let's fast forward, He said it is very good. Yes. All right. Now that's the first day. You might underline or highlight the first day. And it says the evening and the morning were the first day. Now let's pause for a moment before we go any further and look at question number 4. How do we know that each day was 24-hour period and not periods of thousands or millions of years, as the evolutionists say? Now, let me picture for you the dilemma. Our evolutionary friends, our denominational friends, particularly those that are atheists or evolutionists, but the theistic evolutionists, what I'm interested in, say that it took millions of years for the earth to evolve. And they try to harmonize that with Genesis, and they say these days were millions of years in length. And others say, no. Each day is 24-hour periods separated by millions of years, or billions, as Carl Sagan would say, between those days. And some of our brethren have bought into that. How do I know that Genesis 1, when it talks about the first day, that first day is a 24-hour period followed by another 24-hour period? Evening and morning were the first day. What else? Very good. Basic rules of hermeneutics is that a word means what it normally, ordinarily means unless something in the context demands otherwise. So there is something in the context that tells me it must be a 24-hour period because it's an evening and a morning. You might write out to the margin of your text, Exodus 20 compares these 6 days to the 6 days of the work week. So Exodus 29 and 10, 6 days shall you labor, and on the seventh day is the Sabbath of your God. So you work 6 days, you rest, just like, verse 11, 6 days the Lord made the heavens, the earth, and the sea. He did that in the same period of time that you are to work, and then you are to rest on the seventh day. All right, that's not the only text. Exodus 31, same thing, that work shall be done for 6 days, you rest on the seventh, just like in 6 days God made the heavens and the earth. Make sense? So you take those points, and I know then that this is a 24-hour period followed by another 24-hour period. So let's go back to our outline of Genesis chapter 1. What happens on the second day? All right, we have, God said, let there be a firmament in the midst of the waters, and let it divide the waters from the waters. And he said that it was good, and that was the second day. Now, what is this firmament? Well, the ancient Hebrews thought erroneously, and the Egyptians thought erroneously, that that was a solid dome somehow. And the word can mean to stretch out, and it was is used sometimes with reference to beating metal, so that when you take metal and you beat it, and it's getting thinner and spreading out, it's the idea of spreading. And so the ancient Hebrews and the ancient Egyptians thought it was some kind of solid dome that God created, nothing to indicate that at all. It must have been some kind of cloud formation or vapor canopy. It just is the idea that God separated something by separating the waters that were above and the waters that were below. Now, he identifies the firmament as being heaven in verse 8. In fact, it's mentioned about 5, 6, 7 times here in this context. Now, I would refer you to Apologetics Press. Do a Google search for Apologetics Press, then do a search on their site for the firmament. You'll find a nice little article there about the firmament. Third day now. What happens on the third day? Took the waters that were under the firmament and divided it from the land, all right? And he created vegetation. Very good. He brought forth the grass and the herbs and the fruit and the fruit tree that yields fruit after its kind. And the earth brought forth the grass and the herbs. Each had that seed in itself. I'm skipping some points to get down to our point at verse 12. God saw that it was good. So as you see on your screen, God divided the waters from the land. He created the grass, the trees, and the plants. And that's for mankind and for the animals that are going to come a little bit later, as we'll see in chapter 2. Now, on the fourth day, he did something.
Separated the days from nights.
Yeah. He created a greater light, which would be the sun, to rule the day, and the lesser to rule the night. And he made the stars also. Verse 16. And he set them in the firmament of the heavens. That gives me some idea of the firmament that he's mentioned, the expanse, your footnote will say. And so God created the stars and the moon and the sun, etc. Now, the fifth day, we're going to focus more on the sixth day for an obvious reason. What happened on the fifth day? The sea creatures and what else? Birds of the air. The birds of the air and the sea creatures he created in verses 20 to 23. Now, starting at verse 24, we have through verse 31, the end of the chapter, we have God creating the cattle and the beast, and then we have the creation of man at verse 26. So God said, let us make man in our image, he said. And I reference to the triune being of the Godhead. But I'm more interested right now at verse 26, that man is going to have dominion over what? All right. And so that tells me man has dominion over the animals. Man is superior over the animals because man is made, verse 27, in the image of God. Now let's fast forward to chapter 2 and in verse 7, lest I forget to make this point later. God breathed into man the breath of life and he became a living, your translation, if you have the King James, may say, a living soul. That just means a living being. That didn't refer to his soul, his spirit that lives on beyond the grave. And so he's a living being. That's not what made him special. What makes man special is chapter 1, 27, he's made in the image of God. And so that makes him superior to the animal kingdom. Now God told man that he's to be fruitful and multiply and replenish the earth. But I'm interested at verse 29 and 30. what God tell man concerning all the herbs and the plants that he's created? Good for food. This is for your food, and so God has it to reproduce because it has seeds. So man has perpetual food available, and so and it's for the beast as well, as verse 30 indicates. Every creeping thing on the earth, God has provided for creation through the herbs. Now you might make a marginal note. God made provision for the eating of meat later, not at this juncture. And so you say, well, where is that? Chapter 9, verse 3. Make a marginal note if you want to look at that later, and we'll get to that in chapter 9. And so if we close our Bible here, man's not given permission to eat meat at all. But he will in chapter 9 and in verse 3. So he's to eat the herbs at this point. So that's the sixth day, and there's the 6 days of our creation. A footnote now. And what I mean by a footnote, I want to back to this thing of being 24-hour periods or not. If these days are millions of years each, or separated by millions of years, then the sixth day, and we're told, by the way, we're living in the seventh day because it's millions and millions of years. We're still in that. And man was created on the sixth day. That means man was created closer to our time than at the beginning, right? And yet Jesus said, God at the beginning made them male and female. Isn't that interesting? That won't fit with evolution. That won't fit with theistic evolution. And so if these are millions of years each, or separated by millions of years, man was created closer to our time than at the beginning. But Jesus said it was at the beginning. I believe Jesus. Either Jesus was wrong or the evolutionists are wrong, one or the other. That is right. That is right. Not realistic. All right. Now let's go to chapter 2. Now I want to say something about chapter 2 before we get into chapter 2. There is a common thought that Genesis 2 is a different account of creation. Another creation. You may be familiar, and if you're not, you might Google this. The J, these are initials now. Capital J-E-D-P theory. And that's simply a theory that says Moses didn't write all of the Bible. He compiled this from various sources. And it's based on this idea that this is another account, not the same account we just read in Genesis 1. It's a different account of a creation. And it gets confusing. But it's based on the idea that God is referred to as Elohim in chapter 1 and Yahweh in chapter 2. Well, that's absurd. That's just based on assumption. I might refer to one of you by your first name, or I may refer to you by your occupation. Someone may call me and say, hey, Donnie, or they may say, hey, preacher, or on some occasions they say, hey, carpenter, come here. Does that mean they're different people? No. They're just using different terms. And the same thing is true with reference to God. God is Yahweh. He is Elohim. That's just a basic senseless argument. But the point is that this is not a separate account of a creation. What we have in chapter 2 is an expansion of chapter 6. We saw in chapter 1 the 6 days of creation. Just a quick synopsis. And so it's like God said, I want you to know more about day 6. Okay, chapter 2, he's going to tell us more. So let's take a peek at chapter 2. So verses 1 to 7, I call this simply man in the garden because that's the fundamental point in chapter 2. 1 to 7, creation is finished and God rested on the seventh day. Now, I want you to notice that God had finished on the seventh day and he rested on the seventh. And we see that again in Exodus 20 and Exodus 31. And he rested from all that he had done. So this was not something where God created even in six literal days and then it evolves over time. This is what God had done. Reminds me of Psalm 33. He spoke it and it was done. It stood fast. Now verse 3 has to be stated from the standpoint of the time that it was written, not at the time of creation. Here's what it says. Then God blessed the seventh day and sanctified it because in it he rested from all his work and had created which he created and made. I think that's made in light of Exodus 20 and Exodus 31, that at Sinai, as the law is being given, God is sanctifying this day as a special day, and you're to rest just like he did. So I think this is being written post-Sinai. Make sense? Not that it occurred, creation occurred at the beginning, but Moses is writing about that post-Sinai, I'm assuming, and there is some assumption, and I'm going to leave it at that, that I think that he probably wrote that after that, and so after this law had been given about the Sabbath, Moses inserts here and makes the point that he sanctified that day because this was the day that God rested. All right. Now, verse 4, 5, 6, and 7, let's wrap that one up. This is the history when God created the heavens and the earth and talks about the plants and the herbs had grown. What did God do after the plants, what we saw in chapter 1, had been created before the whole creation is finished? How did he take care of those plants? All right. He caused it to rain on the earth, and there was no man to till the ground, but there was what? A mist that came up and watered the whole face of the earth. Now, the Lord, now he's not going back and telling us that here's another occasion where God created man, but this is telling us what he'd done on the sixth day. The Lord took the dust of the ground and breathed into his nostrils the breath of life, and he became a living being, a living soul. In the same sense that animals have soul, they have life. Not a soul, a spirit that lives on, but they have life. Man has three, a triune being, spirit, soul, and body, 1 Thessalonians 5:23. Now, I did all of that to get to verse 8 now. Let's talk about man in the garden. Now, the Garden of Eden. Let's pause for a moment. Well, let's talk about man there, and then we'll get the description of the rivers and so forth. God planted a garden eastward in Eden, and he put man there. And what else do you see in verses? Let's get verse through verse 14. All right, there were rivers coming out. There are four major rivers. There was Pishon, and there was Gihon. The Tigris River mentioned at verse 14. If you have Hiddekel in your translation, look at your footnote. It'll say the Tigris River, and then there was the Euphrates River. Where was the Garden of Eden? We don't know. The most common thought, now get your bearing here. This is the Mediterranean Sea. This right here is the land of Palestine. This is the Dead Sea, and this is the Sea of Galilee right there where that area is. All right? So this is the Fertile Crescent, and here's the Persian Gulf, and this is the Euphrates River, the Tigris River. The Pishon is thought to come here. And the fourth one, if I can't draw it because my cursor won't go, but if you come right through that chair or through that chair over there, that's where that fourth river is supposed to be. So the more common thought is this shaded area is the area where the Garden of Eden is. Others think it's on up to the other end of those same rivers. But somewhere along that one end or the other of the Euphrates River is the common thought of where it may be. So how does that fit today? Well, that same Persian Gulf, that's where, right here, where Iraq and Kuwait and Iran all meet together, right here in that region, blown up right here. That's where it is thought, the more common thought for the Garden of Eden would be. Do we know for sure? Absolutely not. We don't know. But that gives us kind of a general idea of the common thought. All right, now that's the description of the garden that man's placed in. Now, let's go further at verse 15. What's going on at 15? Puts man in the garden, and he's to do what? He's to cultivate it. So he took man, put him in the garden, and he was to tend and keep it. He was to cultivate the garden, take care of this wonderful, perfect garden. Now, 16 and 17, here's the first covenant that is made. And what is found in verses 16 and 17? Pretty simple law, isn't it? You can eat of any tree that you want, but of this particular tree, you cannot eat of it because if you do, you will die. Die in what sense? Yeah, sin is going to separate you from God. He's also going to die physically, isn't he? Because beginning at that point is where man begins to deteriorate, and we have death beyond that point. All right? Pretty simple law. Not hard to understand. Eat of any tree you want, but of this one you can't, and if you do, you'll surely die. We'll make a point about that next time in Genesis chapter 3. Now let's go to 18 to 25 and talk about the creation of woman. Let's get a question. We haven't got any of those. We hope to get a couple here before we're through. We may. Let's go to number 7. Why is Eve called woman? Taken from man. Yes, she's made from man. Now, why did God create man first? Because God's got the right to choose, and he didn't want any advice while he's making man. That's not in the text. God used that in First Timothy 2. God established leadership from the principle of order of creation. That's what I was after. And you're right, God has a right to choose, and he did. But
the first time that God said something is not good. It's not good for man to be alone.
That's a good point. Very good point. I want us to look at verse 18. When he said it's not good that man should be alone, God said, I will make a helper suitable for him. King James will say help meet. That's not a bad translation. It's not help meet. It's a help that is meet. The word meet means suitable. So it's a helper that is suited to him. Now, because man had looked out among the animals and he didn't find anything that was comparable to him. In other words, he may like the animals, but this is not a companion for him. He can't find companionship in any of the animals. So God said, I will make him a woman. And so he caused a deep sleep to fall upon him, and he took his rib, and from that he made into a woman and called her Eve. Now, look at verse 23. Adam said, what does that mean? Let's stop right there. Good point, Dennis. Bone of my bones. What's he saying? Yeah, this is part of me. She is part of me. In other words, she's not separated from me. She's part of me. This is bone of my bones. She's part of my flesh. She's part of me. She's the other half of me. Yes, ma'am? Absolutely, absolutely. And she was called woman because she was taken out of man. So being a woman is not a secondary role. It's not an inferior role. It was an honor to be the woman that was created. She is a helper suited for him. Now, verse 24, there's a number of commentators that question, is this a statement from Adam or is this a statement from God? And Moses recorded, I don't think it's a statement from Adam, but even if it is, then God must have had him to say that, but nonetheless, I take it to be a statement from God because Jesus later quotes this in Matthew as being God's law on marriage, God's eternal law on marriage, that a man should leave his father and mother and be joined to his wife, and they shall become one flesh. And so there was one flesh. God took the one flesh and made two, and in marriage, he brings them back together as one flesh. One flesh, I'm convinced, means more than the intimate relationship. They're one in goal and aim and purpose, etc., that we don't have time to develop fully. Now, let's get verse 25. That'll finish the chapter, but I want to come to our questions and get some other things out of the way in the last 3 or 4 minutes. Look at verse 25. They were both naked, the man and his wife, and were not ashamed. Now, you've heard me make this point many times about the word naked used through the Scriptures, and we'll make more points about that in chapter 3. But to suffice it to say, to build a foundation to build on, you might write out to the side that the word naked is used in different ways. This term is used here in the sense of being nude. You say, how do you know? Because they hadn't got anything on, because it's not until later they attempt to cover themselves inappropriately, but they don't do a good job. In other words, they don't do a good job. We'll see that in chapter 3. So here the word means nude. But later we'll see they were naked, but they have some clothes on. There's a point to be made about that, but just let's just write that down for the time being. All right. Now, questions or comments? And if this is your first time through this, you see what we mean by survey. That's a quick survey of chapters 1 and 2, and that's kind of how we're going to have to go through this to make it in 5-plus years. Make sense? Absolutely. Let's go to question number 6, Genesis 2:24. Where in the New Testament is this verse quoted? Matthew 19:5 and Mark 10 and Ephesians 5. That's what one of the ones I was after. All right. Matthew 19, Ephesians 5, Mark 10, etc. Question number 2, or point B of 6B. What does this teach on marriage? One man for one woman. It teaches distinct families. Would you agree with that? A man should leave his father and mother. In other words, you don't get married and then you're still under the rule of her father or his father. They're separate families. I learned that from that text, don't you? What else do you learn? Say again.
No other creation suffices.
No other creation suffices. Only the woman suffice for a helpmeet. Good point. Permanence of marriage. That's how Jesus uses it in Matthew 19. He makes a point. In fact, he makes 4 points from that in Matthew chapter 19. Questions or comments? Good point. As we go through the New Testament, building on what she just said there, that all through the New Testament, we're going to have references back to the Old Testament. If we haven't studied the Old Testament, they're going to be meaningless to us. When it mentions the paradise of God, or it mentions the rivers, etc., they're going to be meaningless if we don't have some knowledge of the Old Testament. Question number 8. We've got time for maybe one or two of these. Some good practical lessons that you take home with you from chapters 1 and 2. All right, what else?
All the things that God created was for us, and all these things that the trees would be pleasant to the eyes as well. I mean, it's just, and the thing that, one thing that stuck out to me this time, which I knew about, is that we're created after His own image.
Yeah.
And I looked that word up in the Strong's, and it's resemblance.
Yeah.
It made me think about it.
There's an old saying, God don't make. What is it? God don't make no junk. Everything God made, He said it was good. Made man, He's in the image of God, and He made woman, and He made all of creation, and God didn't make any junk, did He? We'll end on that note right there.